He just doesn't know how to turn on the audio.
How to turn on its own audio. Right. He doesn't know how to turn it. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to go off the call and try to join on the video.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, Alan. I'm not sure what you want to do, Justin.
I may have Rich bail on this one until we figure that out. But let's see what let's give him enough time.
Yeah.
Until because I want Alan to call in too. So let's
okay. Alan we'll wait for Alan and then we could get going. I guess.
Exactly. Oh, one of the two of the things I think we should add. One of which is oddly enough, giving Trump credit where credit is due. His trip to India is a good thing. It would be unfair not to include that as a topic.
Okay. Okay. And.
And the second one is the death of Hosni Mubarak.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. A majority of the people that listen to us, I hear what you're saying. We'll bring it up because I also wanted to talk about Ms. Johnson, of Hidden Figures fame. I wanted to talk to her. So, hey Maddie. Can you type into this chat that we've got?
Say again, Justin.
I'm not sure where the audio controls are.
Wait, oh Jesus. How did this guy get a PhD? Anyway, Maddie, can you help him out window. On this?
I don't know. Can you type to him, Maddie?
I can try.
All right, Justin. Maddie's going to try to type at him with the keyboard.
Okay, thanks.
Edit. Autofill form?
No.
This is a lost cause. I say we throw the towel here.
Spelling and grant, no.
Rich, you're so far off base right now. I think the odds of finding it are almost nil.
Yeah, Rich, we're going to bounce you.
I'm turning up the audio now.
Can you hear us now? No, because I know what the problem is. The audio, I think, is...
That says, turn Wi-Fi off.
No, God,
I've got a bunch of different things.
I don't know why we're talking because he can't hear us.
Rich,
join other network.
Hold on.
Hey, can you see us typing?
Yes. And I want everybody to start using you're using at least good microphone quality and we don't get the feedback, that hissing in the background, so that's a good thing.
I think this is the first time we've had no one in the studio.
Is it something on the bottom of the screen?
No. Oh, God.
this is amazing. Justin, I see Maddie is typing in something. She's in the other room right now.
Okay. Do you know how?
She's trying to send a message.
Okay, thanks.
I think she's listening in too. Oh, that was an interesting angle.
Okay. Wait, what is he doing? I don't understand this.
He's looking for headphones. Because Macs are smart. Actually, most PCs now are smart, so it should automatically detect that he's plugged in and figure that out.
Or he can plug it into the back of, he can plug it into the bottom. If it's a standard 3.5 millimeter, he can plug it into the bottom of the... of the Yeti Blue, because that's what I use.
Does he have a Yeti as well?
Yeah, I told him to buy the Yeti, so we didn't have the bad audio.
We didn't have this problem, right. And now he's looking for a headphone.
He's looking for earplugs. This is great.
Oh, dear. Oh.
So, Charlie, sorry I didn't get a chance to bring Isaac with me today.
I know. I was kind of a little disappointed because I figured if Aaron and Justin weren't here, I'd get to hold the baby finally. But, if I could have a rain check on the baby, that would be okay.
I got the level at the highest it can go now.
Can you hear us? Can you hear us?
No, he can't because I know what the problem is.
Unless there's another way to turn up the audio that I'm not aware of.
Yeah, I think it's just a setting that he's directing it to the wrong place.
Using the output for audio through the mic. If you have earplugs,
Yeah, earplugs, man.
From a phone. Plug them into the bottom of the mic.
Yep.
That will work.
I don't think he's got earphones.
Now that would be too much. That would be too easy.
Whoop.
Somebody. Alan Moore.
The problem is that you are using
Alan Moore
audio through the mic. If you have earplugs from a phone plug, I don't think I have any earplugs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Unfortunately. All right.
Okay.
It's your call, guys.
I can't figure.
I haven't dialed in. Jesus.
Just have him dial in. We're gonna be at them for another 20 minutes.
There you go. Right. Yep. Okay.
Do you want me to come out and come back in?
Dial in.
You gonna send him a message? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see.
Should I come out of here?
Yes.
Actually, in theory, he can dial in and listen through the dial in and talk through the online thing, can he?
Yeah, he could.
I think so.
That yeah, he could. But at this point. Alan Moore, you're on mute.
No. Alan?
Alan is on mute, if you can hear us, Alan.
Huh. He was there, and now he's not there.
No, I can't figure this out. Okay. We can do... Okay, let's... Alan, do you have... Can you hear us? Because you're on mute, Alan.
Well, maybe he's getting a cup of coffee.
That could be too.
Yeah.
You can't unmute somebody.
Or he doesn't have a microphone on his computer.
Oh, that could be too. That could be too. I didn't even think about that. You know what? I try to go for the audio quality.
Yeah.
From now on, I'm just going to put out to everybody, look, try and figure this out. Maddie, thank you for being in studio.
Okay.
You're holding down the fort. And it's so much. Ooh. It's so much less hectic than having two babies. And also, we'll figure that out.
All right. You want to kick it off and just see what happens?
Let's kick it off, and we'll take it from there. Dan, you and I'll kick it off. Alan, if you can hear us, just try and dial in. But we got to get the. I'd like to get this fixed for next week if we can, because you. I don't know if you have a camera and or a microphone, if you can hear us. So anyway, because you're still on mute and you have to unmute yourself on the program.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway,
I can see that from here. Yeah.
We'll have everybody else dial in as needed.
I'll mute you guys and I'll start the music and I'll bring it back. Okay.
Thanks.
From Studio A in Podcast Village, Upper Georgetown, Washington, D.C., this is the best political talk show you've never heard of. It's Backroom Politics with your host and moderator, Justin Russell.
Hey. Technical difficulty. You know you can't make this stuff up. This is the best political podcast you've never downloaded, and it is a very remote edition. I'm your host and moderator, Justin Russell, from... my home office in central eastern Florida, over on the beach side of Melbourne. Joining me, as they do every time we record this, he is the former Democratic political operative and I guess he still is a Democratic political operative and a bar certified attorney in the great state of Maryland and the District of Columbia. He is the one we know as Dan Lipner Esquire. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, and I blame the Russians for our technical difficulty.
Yeah, I hear you. And joining us from a remote location in Northwestern Virginia, he is the former assistant, former undersecretary for international commerce or for international trade at the Department of Commerce. He is the one we know as the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin.
And also joining us from a remote location, he's the author of such books as American Politics on the Rocks. He is our in-house historian. He is Rich Rubino. Hello, Rich.
Hello, Justin.
And keeping us honest behind the boards, he is the one, our host, our benefactor, and now engineer, The one we know is Charlie Burney. Hello, Charles.
Hello.
And of course, Maddie, the engineer, is in the empty Studio A.
Hello.
Podcast Village, where we would normally. Oh, there she is. Hey, Maddie. Thanks for joining us. Hey, obviously, there's a lot going on. There is a ton of stuff to cover. The big thing everybody's talking about right now, especially since we record this on a Tuesday, if you haven't been looking, the stock market has lost anywhere from about 5 to 6% just in a 24 to 48-hour period. It is something that started up above 29,000. It is now at last check somewhere around 26,000. The 6%, a big hit, the worst 2 days that the stock market has seen in a long time. It is still not the 20% drop that we saw on Black Monday over a decade ago, but it is still taking a toll. The question is why. A lot of economists, a lot of people on Wall Street are talking that this is, in fact, something that has to do with the coronavirus. The coronavirus is in the thralls of becoming what some at the World Health Organization are now calling a pandemic. The question is, number one,
the World Health Organization has deliberately not used that word. So I think we shouldn't put words in their mouth.
Okay, it has become a disease of international significance. We'll put it that way, but it is definitely getting attention. Just in 24 hours, we have seen 100% rise in the number of cases being recorded in Italy. That from the Italian Health Ministry. We've also heard that the Iranian health minister or one of their key health ministers has been diagnosed with the coronavirus. This has had economic ramifications all over the place. But the big question we have right now is, with the economic heat that our economy has been in, can we, in fact, survive a large-scale disease scare such as what we're dealing with, coronavirus? Alan Moore, I'm going to start with you as the former Undersecretary for International Trade. How big of a problem is something spreading this rapidly that doesn't seem to have a vaccination? In fact, Dr. Fauci, who's the director of the National Institutes of Health Center for Infectious Diseases, said that any sort of antidote or vaccine is a year to a year and a half out from deployment. Is this an economic threat?
It's a significant economic threat. At the moment, the problem, there are two problems. One, because of the significant disruption in the Chinese economy, with entire cities and regions being in effect shut down and lots of factories being shut down, the supply chain for this, as it's called, for U.S. product. Sometimes it's a finished product. Sometimes it's component parts for products that are put together in America. Sometimes it's components of something like a pharmaceutical drug that might be produced here, but some of the chemicals come from China. There are thousands and thousands of different products that are at the moment being disrupted. And when the West started looking at these disruptions and trying to project into the future, they realized there is a potential economic slowdown all over the place in Western markets, whether or not a given country has got a serious coronavirus problem or not. So that's point one, the disruption. It took a little while for the market, seemed to me, to catch up to this, but it happened over the weekend. The Dow Jones is down 6%, by the way. It's right at 27,000 right now, and it was just over 29,000 2 days ago. So,
right.
So it's down 2,000 points, and there's no good news yet that would seem to cause it to stall. Having said that, the U.S. economy is still, in strong shape.
Yeah, but here's the question for you, Alan. Is and then I want to go. I then want to go to Dan. But the question to you I have is our economy vulnerable because of what's happening with the coronavirus in China, with the European Union and in Italy? Is our economy extremely vulnerable or extremely susceptible to this because of just-in-time logistics, which has seemed to become something that we're seeing more and more big box companies and large-scale economic drivers go to now?
Yeah, that was my reference to the supply chain.
Right.
Stuff is produced, it's moved internationally. A lot of it's finished product, the things that you buy in Walmart that say made in China. Well, I don't mean to pick on Walmart, every store in America, basically. Those are finished goods that come. Some of them are on ships on their way, but everybody knows that there's disruption now and there's going to be this slowdown and catch up. But then there are all these other parts, especially in the electronics field, where component parts or components, pieces that are already put together that have to be added to something else, are being shipped. Tourism is hugely impacted, which means airlines, cruise ships. There's all sorts of factors that are right now being disrupted, and
right.
This interconnectivity of world markets is disrupted everywhere.
It's
not just China. South Korea's hit. We've got this problem in Italy. Italy's problem is not huge yet. It's just that it took some big jumps. So the numbers aren't anywhere near what they are in.
But
in,
you're talking about
in
a,
South
you're talking
Korea.
About a hundred. You're talking about 100%.
Yeah, but 100% of two. No, 100% of two is two. 100% of a million is another million.
Well, you're talking about you're talking about a jump from 100 to 200. That's still something that shows wide-scale spread issue.
Well, it just some of that is finally catching up to diagnosis and reporting and so on. Yes, Italy's got a problem that's different from the rest of Europe so far, but it's not a massive problem of this. It doesn't have the scale of those Asian countries.
Dan.
The last thing, of course, is the health side of it, that we're still not sure what we're dealing with here,
right.
and it kills 1 to 2% of the people who get the infection. That's a very
high number.
Mortality rate.
Right.
It's a very high mortality rate.
So, Dan Lipner, 2 weeks ago, the Trump administration proclaimed that the spread of the coronavirus didn't cloud any economic outlooks. Yet we've got Goldman Sachs citing the virus, cutting its growth forecast for the U.S. economy by 1 to 2% in the first quarter. And then you've also got the impact, the delayed impact, I think, on the Dow Jones and the other markets, let alone the trouble it's going to have with the international markets, such as the Nikkei, the FTSE, etc. Is it right for the Trump administration to be downplaying the economic impact? Is this trying to kind of calm down fears, or is this naivete?
I don't think it's either. I think it's the since the economy is one of the chief things Donald Trump is running on, anything that damages the economy, suddenly Donald Trump's genius doesn't look so genius anymore. At least there is some anonymous reporting this morning that some economic experts within the Trump administration are calling the coronavirus a possible, quote, black swan event that could really cause some disruptions. And I think one of the stories that caused Wall Street to suddenly take notice was BMW is suddenly having to slow down production because there's now a shortage of parts that are coming from China. So this isn't just the things that show up in Walmart as completed goods, as Alan was talking about, but a lot of those parts that are almost unnoticed that go into everything from cell phones that Apple has already noted that they're not going to meet their forecast because of the coronavirus, and other products downstream that literally have thousands of parts in them, that one of which that might only be produced in China in a place that suddenly is having production issues. This could be something serious. It's still to be seen. The Trump administration downplaying it is arguably a political move, but this is a political town. But it's also a little dangerous, since one of the things that is also at play is, since the Chinese have been known to play fast and loose with the facts, that doesn't inspire confidence. And if this becomes a far worse epidemic and actually does become a pandemic, suddenly faith in institutions is going to matter an awful lot. So global leadership, political leadership, playing fast and loose with the facts is going to be even more challenging.
But does this become a political problem for Trump and Republicans? I mean, you just have a big energy trade deal that Trump has been touting as part of his phase one trade deal with China. Yet this is causing literally container ships full of fuel and commodities to line up like rockets outside of major ports right now. Is this something that is a vulnerability for Trump, or is this something that could possibly give a bump up for Trump, his hard line, his America-centric? Is this going to add fuel to America First?
Well, his hardcore fans that believe, want Fortress America, believe good walls make for good neighbors, and the only thing foreigners have to add is just bad things for us. Yeah, they're going to be with him, but they've been with him from the get-go, so we're not talking about those folks. Trump's already had a misstep early on the coronavirus, saying this is just going to go away once it gets warmer, which is not exactly helpful. He did do somewhat of the right thing by asking for additional funds for the CDC in his appropriations. However, even then, it was still less than what they had requested. So he's definitely been playing this interesting, and if this gets worse, it's going to be a problem.
Rich Rubino, you know, we've seen other administrations deal with this. You know, I remember the SARS issue. I remember the Ebola issue. I also remember the early spread of HIV and AIDS. This one seems to be a little bit more global impact, immediate impact. Is there something historical that we can tie into what we're seeing with coronavirus in the past?
No, I don't know if it's anything that's happened this immediate. I mean, obviously, people can look beyond, you know, America and go back to, you know, obviously, it's nothing like that. But you can go back to the bubonic plague and you can go back to 1918. But there really is nothing, I think, that's quite on this level. And in terms of the Trump administration, you know, this could potentially change. This could be the inflection point of the election, because obviously, as James Carville said, you know, it's the economy, stupid. And the fact that, you know, whether Donald Trump deserves any blame whatsoever, the fact of the matter is that the American people, for some reason, think that the president kind of has plenipotentiary powers, and almost like he waves a magic wand, and the president gets credit for a good economy and takes probably too much credit and probably gets too much blame when the economy goes south. But that being said, Donald Trump is taking credit for the economic recovery, even though it started before his administration. So if he does take credit for what happened prior to his administration, then does that mean that theoretically he would have to take blame for this as well? But from a political perspective, from an actual policy perspective, it's very hard to kind of paint blame specifically on Donald Trump for a virus that is certainly out of his control.
Alan Moore, the president, while on what many are calling a very successful trip to India, during a presser today, as right before we were recording this episode, basically said that, and I'm going to paraphrase, obviously, that this is much ado about nothing, that we've got it under control. The question is, is the Trump administration really playing with fire, on this one. Is how big of a gamble are they taking with the $1.2 billion and then an additional $1.2 billion, basically a $2.4 billion injection of money into CDC, NIH, DHS, HHS for responding to the coronavirus? Too much, too little, too late? Or is the president right when he says, I could have spent $10 billion and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi would have said that's way too much, where they're now saying this is way too little?
You know, I didn't see the India remarks. I think he's been backing off, though, myself, a little bit of the, yeah, everything's under control, all is good message of 2 weeks ago, let's say.
Right.
And I think he, and now they have sought, it is $2.5 billion. They're going to they propose to reprogram some, and then they want another 1.4 or whatever it is as emergency supplemental appropriation from the Congress. And he said, we may need more, and if so, we'll ask for it. So what we don't know, one of the problems, and you mentioned it, I think at the outset, was to come up with a vaccine takes time. You don't just go make an adjustment in a factory somewhere and start producing stuff. We aren't sure what the stuff looks like. So we got to figure out what would work and then start producing it. Now, today, just as the president was, he's trying to be, I think he's not as stupidly upbeat as he was early on, where, you know, he just wanted to go say some reassuring words, not based on obviously good internal information. But the same thing today, where he's trying to be at least not horribly pessimistic or downbeat. The Centers for Disease Control, the CDC's infectious disease expert, said in a briefing with the press, it is almost certain that coronavirus will arrive on our shores. I mean, it's arriving already.
And, yeah, it's already here.
You know, but the point being that it will almost certainly spread here. And the question is, do we have the capability and it's state and local government efforts and kind of SWAT team to go out. We're not even entirely sure on the diagnostics of this thing. And it's just, it's a fast mover.
Yeah.
When we went after Ebola, we provided $8 billion in an emergency. And the difference with Ebola and coronavirus is the mortality rate for Ebola is well over 50%. So it's like, if you get it, you're likely to die.
Right.
And that's not the case with coronavirus, but a mortality rate of
2.5%
is it a higher for women, interestingly, than for men. Higher
for men,
than for women.
It is for women.
Yeah, interestingly, but it is way higher than, for example, the flu. Now, there are millions of cases of flu and thousands of deaths this year from the flu. But the mortality rate, the likelihood of dying from getting the flu
is less than 1%.
Is quite small. It's way below 1%.
Right.
And that's what's so frightening about the coronavirus, and the fact that we're not sure just what it is, where it came from, and what we can do to stop it.
But Dan, you know, this brings up the question, and I'll ask a similar question to you that I asked Alan, is when the president says, look, I could have asked for, you know, 10, 20 billion and they would have complained that's too much or too little. Are the Democrats missing an opportunity here to really show some bipartisanship and saying, okay, look, we can talk about Russia, we can talk about the impeachment, that's one thing. When we're talking about what potentially could turn into an economic and international health crisis, now's the time. We just got to pull it together and really put pen to paper.
Well, the answer is sort of, but there's a reason we have a chief executive in this country. That is the job of the president, and where trust is really going to come into play. Heaven forbid we actually reach the kind of quarantines that the Chinese are doing by walling off places, or the Italians are doing, since the free travel within Europe is a big deal. If we have something like that here, the faith in government and government institutions is really something that goes top down from the executive. And it's nice to expect that from Congress, but the number of Americans that can identify Chuck Schumer, a lot of Americans can identify Nancy Pelosi because she's Speaker of the House, and, well, Fox News runs her picture every opportunity they get with her tearing up.
Right.
But the actual answer here is the President of the United States is supposed to lead us on these kind of things. And when he calls for calm, there needs to be trust in the executive.
This
deal.
Is a-
and Trump playing fast and loose with facts throughout his presidency is going to be a problem.
I understand that, but I guess the question goes back to, and this is where I look at, you know, an opportunity for the Democrats to show that they are the adults in the room, I guess, is my expectation says, you know what, let's put our political differences aside. Mr. President, you and your health, your HHS secretary and your DHS secretary, tell me what you need. We will find the money for it. We will work with your team. To me, this sounds like a great opportunity for there to at least patch up some of the bad blood that's happening in Washington and send a message to the American electorate of, you know what, politics be damned. This is a health issue. This is a public safety issue. Let's fix this and we'll get back to politics in due time.
Right. In which case, the messaging still has to start with the president. There are a zillion people in Congress, or more correctly, 535 members that can vote. There is a single president of the United States. There is a single director of Health and Human Services. There is a single secretary of Homeland Security. If any one of them, ideally the president, but let's go for any of the two offices downstream, say, listen, this is what the United States government is going to do to keep you and your family safe and doing everything possible to not only contain the spread of this virus, but also to find a cure once it does reach our shores.
Right.
That is the purpose of the executive. It is, I think it's just improper to blame Congress for something like this when leadership is looking for executive leadership.
Rich Rubino, do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously just from a perspective of the American people, I think thinking that the president, I think, has more power than they actually do. But I think certainly the president, you know, part of it is just using the bully pulpit and explaining what the situation is, which he hasn't really, you know, elucidated upon, you know, how we got here, because so much of this stuff we just frankly don't know. But it's interesting what was said earlier, though, about the idea of kind of coming together. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, other instances, for example, after 9/11, when, you know, Dick Gephardt and Denny Hastert appeared together and said, essentially, politics is over, and we're going to kind of unify against this. It's almost like, you know, that's something that actually can benefit the president, can benefit all politicians if everyone kind of does come together in that respect and says, you know, this is something we're actually going to work together. We're actually going to work together on. You actually see Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer actually sitting in a room and trying to kind of figure this out from a non-ideological, kind of technocratic, pragmatic point of view.
Alan Moore, do you agree?
Well, there's a potential here, but when they start arguing about, no, it's not enough money, what that tells me is that we don't know how to spend a lot more money. You know, this is a science issue, and money can help at the you know, a bit on the science piece, but some of it just takes time. We could spend 10 times as much on the science. We don't have the scientists or the laboratories to spend that money usefully. Now we can improve capacity of, you know, stuff that we put in place. We can have quarantine plans that we urge the states to assist with local, county, and city governments and stuff. But it's not a matter of rebuilding something, building something faster or better, or even having some massive kind of surveillance like we did after 9/11. And better communications among intelligence agencies. This is the scientific health challenge, and the scientists of the world, the Americans, the World Health Organization, the Europeans, the Chinese, right, the Japanese, Koreans, et cetera, they're all trying to figure this thing out. But it's still a search. There is a point to saying if we appropriated $10 billion, we wouldn't know how to spend it in a useful way. We will right. have the money. That's not going to be a question. And it was like the $8 billion for Ebola. Oh, my God, that was a massive amount of money. Right. And I don't know how much all we spent on it, but that was because we really thought if that stuff gets here, it's just going to start killing people willy-nilly. This one could kill a lot of people. And it's a reminder of our vulnerability to new viruses. I'm not seeing a lot of, hey, great, we're now on the same team. The money will be there. There will be some back and forth along the way, and the president can be his own worst enemy on this stuff if he, as he had done before, underplays and tries to send out an encouraging word about something about which the experts say we don't know enough yet. We're scrambling to figure out what the hell this thing is and whether we can create a vaccine or effective treatment for it.
I want to stay on the economy a little bit because, you know, we've seen where, a series of days of bad days where you're talking 3-4%, 2% drops each day line up. And then we get a slow bleeding of the economy versus the Black Monday approach. It seems that we're putting a lot of emphasis on the health of the economy on the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the New York Stock Exchange. Dan Lipner, is that right? Are we losing the forest through the trees by doing that? Or is this just what American voters get? This is how we can determine a healthy economy. 29,000, 30,000 Dow Jones Industrial Average is what we want.
I mean, for a percentage of America that absolutely views their success through the stock market, yeah, that's part of it. That isn't the average American. What the average American does see is one of the small upsides to the slowdown in global trade will be a reduction in energy costs. Gas prices will go down in part because other people won't be buying because of those slowdowns. However, what will also be noticed is the Dow is making note of, as I mentioned earlier, that suddenly there's manufacturing slowdowns, and those manufacturing slowdowns actually do begin to affect Americans who produce things and Americans who sell things. So at some point, it does actually come home to roost. Now, it's been argued that the Dow's been overinflated, so part of these fears of the runaway from stocks is because people are suddenly going, whoa, wait a second, maybe these prices are too high that we're looking at the stock market. So that could be part of the issue, but there is a tangible issue for, again, people who make things and people who sell things.
Yeah. Alan Moore, we're hearing a lot of economists starting to say, not give dire, disaster predictions, but we're starting to hear a lot of economists starting to rein in their total optimism for continued robust growing economy the way it has under the Trump administration. Is it just that the American voters are ignoring that, or is this we'll cross that bridge when we come to it? Is that a dangerous pothole for the Republicans as well?
Well, so the president loves to tout the new records for the Dow. And those are not insignificant, but I would say a more important measure of people's feeling about the economy is the unemployment rate, which has been at historic lows. So people who want to work have been able to find jobs. Sometimes they'll have to work two jobs. There's been some increase in wages at the lower end in the last couple of years. It doesn't speak to the inequality question. It just means that a remarkably high number of people, percentage of people in America, have been relatively satisfied with their economic situation. And
but is there a sense of false hope there?
Well, I don't know. No, it's not false hope. It's reality. They're working, and they weren't working before, and their kids are going to get are working. And so it's a fragile economy, and it's not nearly as strong and robust as the president would have people believe when he talks about how bad it was before and how great it is now. Best economy ever, best economy in the history of the world. He creates these images with exaggerated talk, not backed up by the facts. And he's setting himself up, as people have noted, and we have noted on this show, for a fall if something should happen. Well, you know something? Something is now happening, and it's called the coronavirus, and the stock market has lost about 6% of its value in just 2 days. And as Dan talked about, as I talked about before, this whole supply chain business of component parts that go into larger products, Dan mentioned BMWs, but mine was a more generic reference, mean that suddenly factories in the West, in America, in developed countries, are not going to be able to turn out the cars and refrigerators and televisions and cell phones and so on, computers that we expect. Yeah, and so you know there's going to be some layoffs. It's an economic slowdown right now that we're facing. How long and how deep, we don't know. But at the moment, there are all kinds of factories in China that provide stuff that are not operating.
Right.
And so how long will it take before the companies on the receiving end will not have the component parts they need to continue producing? And then the sellers of those products are not going to have the products they need to sell, whether it's cars, which is sort of easy to figure out, or all kinds of other products that one can think about. You have an economic slowdown, and when that occurs, there are layoffs. So suddenly there's a potential for increased unemployment. That's a ways down the road, but that's what the stock market is adjusting for.
Let me ask this question though. You know, we see the American heartland where, you know, we've got good jobs. It may not be the ideal job set where some families are having to work 2-3 jobs to make it sustainable. But most of the people in middle America seem to be happy with the way the economy is going. With the issue of the coronavirus, with the backup in the logistics chain, with all of that, is this a matter of we're not going to see ramifications of the economic downturn until we start seeing $30 t-shirts at Target, whereas 6 months ago we were paying $15 or $10. We start paying $40 for Old Navy jeans, where a year ago we were paying $14. Is it that simple, or are we oversimplifying it in that instance?
No, I mean, it's hard to pick a particular example of a product. You know, people, if it's a handful of products, people will forego buying new stuff if it's priced too high or more than they're willing to pay. But when your dishwasher goes on the fritz and you have to get a new one, will there be dishwashers for you to buy? You'll hire repairmen to come out and fix one that's 15 years old. It's not worth the $300 to repair it. I mean, it's it's products all across the line. And it's not that, I mean, people can usually postpone. They don't have to buy a new car just like they were going to.
Right.
And they can wait another 6 months to buy a new BMW. But the people at the factory who put them together, the guys in the showroom who sell them, they're the ones who you know, everybody along the chain of production and sales is potentially at risk. And that's the potential downturn. And if people are nervous, what's happening? What's this disease? What's it going to do? I'm scared. I'm going to postpone spending. So people don't buy at the same rate they have been in this environment of higher level of confidence.
So Dan Littner, to me,
it doesn't take a lot of percentage of reduced spending to start showing up in the job numbers.
Right. Dan Littner, to me, this almost sounds, again, I know we talked about this earlier, but it almost seems like this is leading into, hey, if I can't import this stuff, using Alan's reference to, I'm going to buy, my dishwasher's on the fritz. Normally I would buy an LG from Europe or a Samsung from the Far East. I'm not going to pay double for that. All of a sudden, that Amana that I would have put together in Amana, Iowa, is starting to look real attractive. Could this be the spark of not so much an American first, but almost a wake-up call for American manufacturing to take hold again in the American economy?
No, at least not quickly. One of the things, since we started this with the coronavirus, one of the things that's even slower than coming up with a cure for the virus is retooling for manufacturing. That kind of stuff takes years. And we've had a colossal downgrade in our manufacturing infrastructure. And contrary to the Trump administration's chatter about the booming economy, we've still had basically a manufacturing recession. There is no sign that we have the ability to start up that kind of infrastructure quickly at all. So, yeah, it could be done, but it's a 5 or 10 year process. It can't happen tomorrow.
Right.
And furthermore, further to Dan's point, those KitchenAids and Amanas have foreign made parts in them all over the place. And I think that sort of speaks to Dan's point. Not only are they not in a position to double their output, but if they were trying to double their output, they would have to double their imports of the component parts that are made overseas that are in those American products. There is no U.S. automobile that doesn't have at least 30 to 40% foreign made parts. And the same is true of other hard goods across the board. I mean, there is this international dependency that you can't undo in any kind of a short period of time.
Hey, Richard Urbino, to go historical, we hear the stories of 1928 leading into 1929, the Herbert Hoover years, and the spectacular economy that everybody thought we had, and then we had the crash. Is this 1929, and is Donald Trump Herbert Hoover?
I don't think so. Although I will say, in terms of Herbert Hoover, a lot of the blame that Herbert Hoover got was not necessarily his fault. What he is known in history, though, is by exacerbating the problem by signing the Smoot-Hawley tariff, which put tariffs on foreign goods, and as a result, the retaliatory tariffs. And a lot of people blame that for Herbert Hoover. The other thing a lot of people blamed Herbert Hoover for was not doing enough to try to stimulate the economy, although he did have some pre-New Deal domestic programs. But in terms of Herbert Hoover, I think that when he came in 1929, he said that he campaigned in 1928, essentially saying he was going to end poverty. Just like Donald Trump, he made a lot of promises that potentially he could not keep. And then when this stuff did not happen, the American people did not say, well, it's not really the president's fault. There are all these other factors as well. They blamed Herbert Hoover, and as a result, in 1932, he was wiped out by Franklin Roosevelt in an election when he probably shouldn't even have gotten the Republican nomination. I think in Donald Trump's case, I don't think he's going to be blamed for the economic slowdown. I don't think the economic slowdown is going to be anything like the Great Depression, in part just because, the Great Depression, remember, it started his first year in office in 1929, so he had the entire administration to have to deal with it. In Donald Trump's case, we know at least in the macro level, the economy has been pretty good for the first 3 years. So I think if there does become an economic downturn, I don't know how many people are actually going to say this is all directly Donald Trump's fault versus people saying there are forces beyond the president's control. The president just has to kind of give the image that he's kind of doing what he can to try to ameliorate the problem, I think.
Right. So last question. We've only got a couple more minutes left before the end of this episode. But two yes or no questions, which I know is impossible for this crowd. First question is, are we going to continue to see drops? I guess the yes or no question is, does the Dow drop below 22,000 in the next couple of weeks? Dan Lipner?
Impossible to know.
Alan, you agree?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, a 10% correction would take it down to 26,000, and that's a kind of a normal 10 to 15% is sort of the historic normal quote correction. But yeah, this one is driven by all the unknowns of a disease that kills people.
Well, on top of the fact that we're also dealing with, you know, economic forecasting that economists have been saying, look, we've been talking about this for 6 months. Now you guys are just starting to hear us now that we've started to see. I mean,
No, I don't agree with that. I mean, even the Goldman Sachs thing. Goldman Sachs a month ago was predicting 2.3% growth in the GDP, in the economy this quarter. They adjusted that down to 1.9 yesterday. So
right,
they lopped off 0.4% of their estimated growth rate for this quarter because of coronavirus. The president wants 3 and 4% growth, not happening, hasn't happened, won't happen. But no, people have been saying, you know, things are remarkably stable and strong. Don't pay attention to the president, pay attention to what these economists are predicting, and they're adjusting down for this quarter. Now we'll see what happens with this disease in the next month or two. It might correct itself. Dan made a reference to how Trump said it'll correct itself when the weather warms up. Well, what he said was he had talked to Premier Xi of China, who he has a lot of confidence in, who he thinks is going to be on top of this, and attributed to Xi the notion that it should go away when the spring comes. He was quoting Xi. This wasn't his quote. It was attributed sometimes to him.
Which is worse? Alan? I mean, worse in that instance?
Well, he said, "I talked to Xi. Xi believes that it will go away in the spring." That's all he said. And then people said, "Oh my God, what an idiot! He's saying it's going to go away in the spring." He was simply repeating what he was told by Xi. Whether that was a good idea or not, fine, but he wasn't owning those words.
Okay,
fair. That's all.
Fair. Okay, fair enough. All right, we're going to let that be the last word. By the way, thank you, Charlie Burney. Thank you very much for putting up with us today and getting us squared away. Our next episode is also going to be a remote broadcast, so just get ready for that interesting little tidbit. On behalf of Rich Rubino, Alan Moore, Dan Lipner, Charlie Burney, and Maddie the Engineer, thank you guys very much back there in Washington. I'm your host and moderator, Justin Russell. Hey, you can also download us as your favorite podcast on your podcasting services. Google, Apple, Spotify, TuneIn Radio. We're everywhere now. We're kind of a big deal. We're still working on the Patreon page to get you, because this stuff is expensive and we've got to pay our bills at some point. And we also want to say thank you very much to our associates this semester. We got Maddie, we've got Emma, and we've got Thomas. Thank you guys for all your help. We will be back with the best political podcast you've never downloaded. This is Backroom Politics. Have a great week, America. See you. or are we?
I think you guys can talk to each other now, actually.
Okay, yeah, we can talk to each other.
Sorry about that. Took me a second. I'm alone here.
Wait a minute. Where's our...
Maddie's not here. Gone. Your guy's not here. Where's Maddie? Maddie is here. Never mind. Belay that as you were.
All right, talk amongst yourselves.
Give us
about 2 minutes, guys.
Got it. Okay.
5:02, 5:03, we'll start up.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay. All right.